I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. Our guest, John Nagle, says it was a mistake to invade Iraq in 2003, a mistake to leave in 2011, and a mistake not to arm the Syrian rebels in 2012. Nagle is a retired Army lieutenant colonel who fought in both Iraq wars and wrote an influential book about fighting insurgencies titled Learning to Eat Soup with a Knife. He admits in his new book, Knife Fights, that it was difficult translating those ideas to the battlefield in Anbar province, where he was stationed in 2003 and 2004, and where a number of his soldiers were killed. He writes about his war experiences, how they have helped him understand how warfare has evolved, the challenges posed by insurgencies, and the lessons not learned by the military. John Nagle made a big career change last year to become the headmaster of the Haverford School in suburban Philadelphia. And John Nagle, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's lovely to be back, Marty.
So are we engaged in our third Iraq war?
We are in our third Iraq war, and it's absolutely sickening to those of us who fought, certainly in the second one, in the Iraq war from 2003 to 2011. The warnings were unanimous from national security experts that if the United States did not leave a force of perhaps 20 or 25,000 soldiers in Iraq, that all of the gains of the preceding 5 years, the creation of a nascent democracy in Iraq, some reasonable progress in building security services that were non-sectarian, the creation of a degree of economic progress in Iraq, which I saw. So I fought, as you said, there in 2003, 2004. I went back in the summer of 2008 when General David Petraeus had succeeded with the surge in the counterinsurgency strategy, and I saw jewelry stores selling gold with plate glass windows in Baghdad. So economic progress, dramatic economic progress, a very safe society really out of the ashes of a horrible war, and that has all come crashing down.
But do you think 20 to 30,000 troops could have, in a sense, kept the peace in Iraq, knowing how deep the divisions are and how violent and bloody that war was?
It wouldn't have been sufficient, but it was necessary. And so those 20,000 or so American troops would have been advisors to the Iraqi army, to the Iraqi police force. They would have helped them continue to progress, not just in military skills, but also in responsiveness to civilian control. Perhaps most importantly, that degree of American influence would have served to coerce Iraqi Prime Minister al-Maliki, a Shia, from exercising his worst sectarian tendencies. So literally the day after American troops all departed at the end of 2011, Maliki started firing important Sunni leaders of the country, whom the previous American administrators, leaders in Iraq, had protected. And Maliki's decision to do that, to re-inflame the sectarian civil war inside Iraq, is a big part of the reason why his military forces have been so ineffective against ISIS, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, over this past year.
But as you know, the Obama administration says there was a status of forces agreement, and this was an agreement fashioned under the Bush administration. We were just abiding by that agreement.
So a status of forces agreement is legal protection for American soldiers. We have literally dozens of them with countries around the globe. There were negotiations to create a status of forces agreement. The Obama administration insisted that that agreement, that draft agreement, be ratified by the Iraqi parliament. That would have been an extraordinarily difficult vote for any Iraqi parliamentarian to take. The Obama administration has not had enormous success getting treaties passed through its own Senate, which is much less divided than the Iraqi parliament is. So that was really, I think, an unreasonable request by the administration. Al-Maliki, Prime Minister al-Maliki, was willing to sign an executive agreement with the President of the United States that would have provided, in my eyes, the eyes of many observers, reasonable protections for American soldiers. And it's worth pointing out that we currently have 1,500 American troops on the ground in Iraq without a status of forces agreement, so we could have found a way around this. I think that this was a convenient excuse for an administration that really didn't want to leave American troops in Iraq.
But don't you think al-Maliki could have been pressured from afar? There was no reason for us to be in Iraq to pressure him. There are outside pressures, like money, for instance.
Although Iraq is a reasonably wealthy country, we could have used economic power more effectively. I think that's certainly true. We also could have used diplomacy. So Iraq became a far less important issue for President Obama than it had been for President Bush. President Bush engaged in weekly teleconferences with al-Maliki to try to influence him. The president did that on perhaps an annual basis. And so the president, the administration clearly wanted to put Iraq in the rearview mirror, didn't want to think about Iraq anymore, thought that that problem had been solved. What they didn't properly appreciate, in my eyes, is that the enemy gets a vote. And the fact that we would like to be done with the war doesn't necessarily mean that we don't still have interests in the region. And that's what's drawn us back now into what I'm calling the third Iraq war against ISIS.
And I want to pick up on that. But how much do you think, and you write and you have talked about the fact that the second Iraq war was a mistake to begin with and launched full of riddles and, I mean, full of errors, riddled with errors. How much do you think what is happening in Iraq today is a result of that invasion in 2003?
There's no doubt that the invasion of Iraq in March of 2003 was an enormous blunder, perhaps the worst mistake ever made by the United States of America in foreign policy. So an unbelievable mistake, an unnecessary war in the first place, conducted to remove weapons of mass destruction that didn't exist, and then very poorly conducted, insufficient troops, insufficient planning, no plan at all for what was going to happen once Saddam's government was toppled. I'm a student of St. Augustine, who's taught us that the only purpose of a war is to build a better peace. We had no plan to build any kind of peace at all after Saddam Hussein was toppled, and then made a series of inexcusable blunders, disbanding the Iraqi army, which was absolutely necessary to secure the country of Iraq in the wake of Saddam's departure, the most functional institution in Iraq, and we disbanded it completely. So the errors absolutely compound each other, and certainly if we're ranking degree of errors, the decision to invade Iraq in 2003 was a worse error than pulling the troops out in at the end of 2011, but neither of them were good moves, and both of them have very deleterious effects for American national security for decades to come.
People say that ISIS is an offshoot of al-Qaeda in Iraq, and my understanding as well is it includes former members of the Iraqi military. Why do you think they have been so successful? They've been successful on the battlefield in Iraq and also in Syria.
Yeah, and even more concerningly to me, they've been very successful in information operations, global information operations. So there's news today that the United States has stopped three Colorado girls from going over to Turkey to join ISIS. Hugely worrying. So they've been successful for a number of reasons. They do have a very virulent ideology. These are people who believe, as al-Qaeda does, that it is the mission of Muslims to recreate the Islamic Caliphate of the 7th century. They are willing to stop at nothing to accomplish that. They are assisted as well by the mistakes al-Maliki made, disenfranchising his Sunni population. This is a Sunni group, and the western third of Iraq, Al-Anbar province, where I fought in 03 and 04, is overwhelmingly Sunni. When ISIS began to emerge pretty quickly after the departure of all of the American troops, an offshoot of al-Qaeda in Iraq, which was an organization I fought against, done grave damage to, but there were embers still, and they reemerged. The people of Al-Anbar, many of them believed that ISIS might be better than their own government in Baghdad. And so Maliki really paved the way for the reemergence of an al-Qaeda-affiliated threat to not just to his government, but to the whole Middle East and, frankly, to the whole world.
The United States spent millions, maybe even billions of dollars training the Iraqi military, and at least early on, they just folded in the face of ISIS. Did we not know how to train for an insurgency like ISIS?
So we certainly didn't know how to conduct counterinsurgency ourselves, much less train other people how to conduct counterinsurgency. Early in the Iraq War, we got better at that. I was part of that process, helped General David Petraeus of the Army, General Jim Mattis of the Marine Corps write the Army Marine Corps Counterinsurgency Field Manual. So we got better at that. But ultimately, war is about politics, and here is another place that I blame al-Maliki. He fired an awful lot of the Sunni commanders we had trained. Maliki was more concerned about a coup against him, led by his Sunni-dominated army, than he was about any external threat from ISIS or anyone else. And so he removed an awful lot of his capable commanders over the last several years, replaced them with cronies, personal friends who had no military training or experience, but were personally loyal to him. When ISIS approached, those guys fled, and a unit without a commander, not tied together by a chain of command, is pretty easy prey. I was actually impressed by how hard a number of the units fought, despite shortages of ammunition, water, weapons, and very, very poor leadership. But Maliki really, really paved the way for ISIS to be where it is now, really on the gates of Baghdad.
But do you think the airstrikes that are being led by the United States, can that defeat a group, an organization like ISIS?
Defeat is a pretty hard task. What they can do is slow ISIS down. They can make things more difficult for ISIS. I've got some problems with our current campaign against ISIS. I don't think we're taking this war very seriously. We're currently averaging about 7 airstrikes a day across Iraq and Syria. That's about one-fifth of what I think a reasonable amount of airstrikes would be given the threat we're facing. It's actually about 5%. It's 1/20th. It's a minuscule pinprick attacks. And those airstrikes aren't as effective as they could be because we don't have American combat air advisors on the ground with the Iraqi units calling those airplanes in. And so I think the president has the right objective in the fight against ISIS to defeat and ultimately to destroy it. I think he has the right way identified to do that is rely on Iraqi and Kurdish forces to do the fighting on the ground. But the means to enable that to happen, American air power, American intelligence support, American logistics support, needs to be delivered through American combat advisors, about 10 times the number we now have on the ground, about 15,000 rather than 1,500, who will make that air power far more effective.
You're talking about boots on the ground, the returning of U.S. ground troops or more ground troops to Iraq.
So there are already boots on the ground. I promise those 1,500 guys are wearing boots right now, and the problem is that they're being held back from the front lines of battle, and they are being helpful, but they're not being as helpful as they could be, particularly given the demoralized Iraqi army really needs new, more effective leadership. We have American Special Forces teams designed for just this purpose. They're currently being held back away from the battlefield. My belief is that within the next several weeks, you're going to see them being pushed forward, and I think then a much more robust campaign will be conducted against ISIS.
Of course, and we're almost up on the break here. As you know, the president ran for president to get us out of Iraq,
and here we
are again.
And it must be enormously difficult for him going back into Iraq, starting another war in Iraq, and starting a war in another Muslim country inside Syria. And frankly, doing so, having to do so, because of mistakes made by his administration, that he was warned. He was warned that this would happen if he pulled all American troops out. And sadly, those warnings have proven prescient.
John Noggle is our guest in this hour of Radio Times, a retired lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army. He served in both Iraq wars, and he's got a new book. It's called Knife Fights, subtitled A Memoir of Modern War in Theory and Practice. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. Give us a call to join the conversation. We'll be right back.
Studio Incaminati, School for Contemporary Realist Art in Center City, Philadelphia, supports WHYY and presents Open House October 25th. The accredited professional program curriculum comes to life during live model painting demonstrations by award-winning instructors. Opportunity for private tours of on-site faculty studios, time to talk with students, instructors, and alumni who are working in the arts, and information about the new Integrated Art Studio major available with Chestnut Hill College. StudioIncaminati.org.
The Association of Delaware Valley Independent Schools, ADVIS, proudly supports WHYY. There are many independent private schools in the greater Delaware Valley. Each offers a combination of nurture and academic challenge, arts, social diversity, community service, connected learning, and critical thinking. To learn more, it's advis.org. ADVIS. Independent schools produce independent people.
The Barnes Foundation supports WHYY and presents William Glackens, the first major exhibition of this Philadelphia-born artist in 50 years, opening November 8th with over 90 of Glackens' work, showcasing the breadth and spirit of a local artist who became America's tastemaker in modern art. On First Friday, November 7th, a vaudeville-themed opening party will celebrate Glackens' exhibition with cocktails, jazz, and circus performances. For tickets, barnesfoundation.org or 215-278-7200.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with John Noggle. He helped to write the Army Counterinsurgency Manual about winning over hearts and minds. He's also the author of a new memoir called Knife Fights. We are talking about the current, war in Iraq. There's no other word for that. And the challenges posed by groups like ISIS. And again, we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. So you fought in the first Iraq war, so this is 1991. You fought in the second Iraq war, 2003. You say we're engaged in another war now in 2014. Are we talking about, in a sense, a war without end, a war without treaties, a war without, you know, the parties coming together and basically saying, okay, we're going to stop fighting each other?
So what's so disturbing to me is that we had achieved that in 2011. When we invaded Iraq unnecessarily in 2003, we disturbed the power structure in that country. The Sunnis had been ruling the country for many years. They'd been put in power by the British, although a minority. They're pretty martial people. And we created democracy in Iraq in 2003 with that invasion, overthrew Saddam Hussein, who was a bad guy. The Sunnis rebelled against the Shia domination that we talked about with Prime Minister al-Maliki, his predecessors. So that led to really civil war in Iraq in 2006. Literally dozens of bodies turning up on the streets of Baghdad every morning, full-scale Sunni-Shia civil war. We put a handle on that. We got a handle on that. We got control of it. General David Petraeus leading the surge, an extra 40,000 American troops into Iraq, and a new strategy designed to build bridges between the communities and to empower Iraqis ultimately to take control of their own country. And over the course of 18 months, the surge, the counterinsurgency strategy, the leadership of David Petraeus led to a decline in violence by 3/4. And it's still a violent place, but I described earlier an economy that boomed and real progress when I visited there in the summer of 2008. That progress continued through 2011, but it wasn't all the way done. The cake wasn't fully baked. And so the presence of 20,000 or so American advisors who would not have been engaged in combat, there wasn't any combat to engage in at that point, but serving as something of an insurance policy, or perhaps even better, as damping rods in a nuclear reactor to keep it from growing critical. When those advisors were removed, when the American presence was removed, the decisions of Prime Minister al-Maliki poured more fuel on the embers of the Sunni insurgency, the al-Qaeda-affiliated rise of ISIS, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, crossed the border in Syria, didn't help. The combination of all of those things with the damping rods out put more energy into the system, and we now are, again, in a low-grade civil war, middle-grade civil war in Iraq.
But if we maintain our presence in a country like Iraq, will we not be seen as some kind of an occupying force, a foreigner that has come to, in a sense, control their country?
And that is certainly a risk. And this was part of the theory that concern was part of the theory that underlay the strategy of followed by General Petraeus's predecessor, General George Casey, in Iraq, that Americans induced such antibodies in the Middle East that we needed to get all the Americans out as soon as possible. And while they aren't necessarily thrilled with having American troops in their country, the American troops are seen as pretty impartial observers. And tend to balance between the different sectarian influences. And so on balance, certainly Prime Minister Maliki was willing to sign an agreement that would have kept 10,000, 15,000 American troops in Iraq. My sense is that if we choose not to do so again, there will be a fourth Iraq war in my lifetime. At some point, I hope we figure this out.
We do have troops in Germany. We have troops in Japan. They are our allies. They're not in the middle of a sectarian warfare. We don't have people shooting. I mean, they may not like us being there, but they're not killing American soldiers.
Absolutely right, and I use those analogies often. So I was one of those soldiers occupying Germany, stationed in Germany early in my career. We drove tanks through their streets. We broke the windshields of BMWs with our tank exhaust. It is not great having tanks drive through your city streets. It's something that Americans don't have to experience very often. But the presence of American troops in Germany, in Japan for decades now, decades and decades, generations, has helped provide the security that has enabled the extraordinary economic boom of the past 70 years and that has... The same presence, the American global security presence, has also led to an extraordinary diminution of great power conflict. So the 20th century, the bloodiest century in man's history, with 20 million dead during the First World War, 40 million dead during the Second World War, great power conflict has almost disappeared. And one of the reasons why is the American security presence acting as sort of a global cop, a global referee around the globe. We need to be proud of that role and understand that while that role has costs, it also has huge benefits, not just for us, but for the whole system.
But do you think that can actually be applied to the Middle East, where there are internal battles, the Sunni-Shia conflict that sort of perpetrates or penetrates almost everywhere, the history of colonialism, the history of oil? I'm thinking of all the reasons why this is such a volatile neighborhood.
It is a volatile neighborhood, and that's where you need the cops, is in the volatile neighborhoods. And we know it works because it did. We saw it work in Iraq from 2008, 2009 to 2011. Violence went if not to zero, went way, way down. And those American troops were not much of a target. My friends who were serving at the time were bored.
Because they had nothing to do.
But just the mere presence of American troops there, the latent power of the United States, the air power on call, all served to enable political progress to happen. And it was happening, and literally the day after we pulled the American troops out, Maliki started firing Sunnis and creating the political environment that led to the military situation on the ground today.
You wrote this book, Learning to Eat Soup with a Knife. This is when you were at Oxford, about insurgencies. And you also write in this current book about how hard that was to apply on the ground when you're actually there dealing with Iraqis, dealing with your soldiers being shot at, in certain cases being killed as well.
And so after I fought in my first Iraq war in Operation Desert Storm, I became convinced that the extraordinary conventional military might the United States had demonstrated in that fight, where we turned the Iraqi army from the fourth largest in the world to the second largest in Iraq in a period of 100 hours, right, that no one would ever fight us that way again. I was convinced that the future of conflict was going to look more like insurgency and terrorism. And so I wrote my doctoral dissertation at Oxford in the mid-90s and titled it after an observation by T.E. Lawrence,
That's
Lawrence
right.
of Arabia,
right.
that war on rebellion is messy and slow, like eating soup with a knife. And then having written the book, I went and did the research in Al Anbar province of Iraq and fought a counterinsurgency campaign for the first time. And though I thought I'd understood intellectually how difficult it was, I did compare it to eating soup with a knife, the actual process of conducting counterinsurgency, when you don't know who your enemies are, when your soldiers are being killed, brutally wounded by an invisible enemy, roadside bombs launched you don't know by whom, and your enemy is, to use Mao's phrase, fish swimming in the sea of the people, indistinguishable from anyone else. It was a far more intellectually demanding war than my previous war, than Operation Desert Storm had been, a very, very frustrating war.
But you're saying this is what war is today and perhaps into the future as well.
As long as the United States maintains its extraordinary conventional military superiority, no one is going to fight us tank on tank. They will lose. They know they will lose. But what they've observed over the last 12 years now of grinding counterinsurgency campaigns in Iraq and Afghanistan is that if you're going to have a hope of defeating the United States, this is how you do it. You don't provide the U.S. with an array of targets to service. You fight with suicide bombers and car bombs and roadside bombs and snipers. You wage war from the shadows, and you have a chance of exhausting the United States, of exhausting our national will, as happened in Vietnam.
So are they winning this war, the insurgents?
So this is that's a very complicated question. The broader story of the last 15 years of war is one of really fairly extraordinary achievements. Al-Qaeda has not been able to conduct another significant attack in the United States. 15 years ago, if you'd asked in the aftermath of September 11th whether we could expect that, no one would have told you yes. And Al-Qaeda has essentially been defeated in the borderlands of Pakistan and Afghanistan by a very successful intelligence and drone war, a shadow war. That's the good news story. The bad news story is that because of mistakes made, the invasion of Iraq in 2003, pulling the troops out in 2011, not arming moderate Syrian rebels in 2012, an al-Qaeda offshoot, an al-Qaeda affiliate, initially al-Qaeda in Iraq, which I fought against in 2004 and now renamed the Islamic State, is now the king of jihadis in the world. It's running Jihadi University. It's fighting a very effective information operations campaign, and it's attracting literally hundreds and hundreds of Westerners, which is the really worrying aspect of this for students of homeland security, for people concerned about their safety here in the United States. These people have Western passports. I mentioned earlier three girls, young women from Colorado were captured apparently attempting to try to join the jihad. People who have been trained in jihad, traveled to fight in jihad, been radicalized, who have Western passports, are a danger to the whole international system for decades to come.
And that's John Noggle, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, a retired Army Lieutenant Colonel. And he has a new book. It's called Knife Fights, a Memoir of Modern War in Theory and Practice. And as we have been talking, he fought in both Iraq wars, helped to write the Counterinsurgency Manual, worked a lot with General David Petraeus about counterinsurgency policy applied to Iraq. And again, we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can join us by email as well, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Let me throw something else in that you have said about the military, which is that they are a slow learner, perhaps, or an institution that learns with resistance. And I know that you and another a person in the military criticized generals for being out of touch in Iraq. How do you see the military? And is it that they want to fight yesterday's wars?
So there are certain kinds of wars that the U.S. military wants to fight. Tom Ricks, a journalist and thinker about these issues, has compared the Civil War to the U.S. Army's Old Testament and World War II to the U.S. Army's New Testament. So these wars ring loudly in the collective consciousness of the U.S. military. It wants to fight big wars against other conventional enemies, uniformed enemies that look like it. However, largely because of its own success in that, it has driven its enemies to fight in other ways. But that doesn't mean that just because that's how our enemies fight us, that that's how we want to fight.
Right.
And so there has been, particularly in the wake of Vietnam, real organizational resistance to retaining the lessons of Vietnam, hard-fought, hard-learned lessons of how to conduct counterinsurgency that then had to be relearned by a military that was completely unprepared to conduct counterinsurgency when rebellions erupted in both Afghanistan and Iraq early in this century. That learning process was far more difficult than it needed to be. And one of the reasons I wrote this book was in the hope that some of those lessons would be captured and would be retained by an organization that despite the fact that it has actually spent more of its history fighting small wars than big conventional wars, really doesn't want to prepare for, plan for, or conduct the small wars that I think are going to be the business of armies for the foreseeable future, for generations.
You had a piece recently, and I guess it's actually this week's Foreign Policy, talking a bit about what you also write about in this book, including the fact that you were, as you said, in Anbar Province, Iraq 2003 and 2004. You write in this piece, when my tank battalion left Anbar after a year of fighting, we made coffee cups that said Iraq 2003 to 2004. We were winning when I left. Then you went on to write, we weren't and we knew it.
And that realization that for the 23 soldiers we had killed, the 150 we had wounded, the literally dozens and dozens of Iraqis we had killed and wounded, probably more, the hundreds we had sent off to detention camps, progress in our sector, peace and stability in our sector of Iraq, were not much further advanced, if at all, than they had been when we'd gotten there, that in fact we'd made a lot of things worse, probably, inadvertently. And we were far from the only unit that had that experience. And this was actually one of the big advantages David Petraeus had when he took over in Iraq in 2007. By then, most of the units were cycling through on their second time, and everybody had realized that what they'd done the first time hadn't worked very well. There was an openness to new ideas, to a sense that building bridges with the local community, that trying to understand their language and culture and politics was probably a more effective way to wage this war. And that realization, I think, opened the door for the most important event on the ground of the Iraq war after the initial invasion, the decision by the Sunni tribes in Al-Anbar first, to stop fighting against us, to stop setting roadside bombs that killed our soldiers, and instead to fight with us on our side against al-Qaeda in Iraq. And that transformation, called the Sawa, or the awakening of the Sunni tribes, really set the conditions for the success of the surge, for the success of the counterinsurgency strategy. And as long as the government of Iraq could keep them on side, presented real hope for long-term stability in Iraq that we squandered.
Is it, though, hard, or was it hard in Iraq to sort of choose sides? And I'm even thinking about Afghanistan. We've done a number of shows about Afghanistan where perhaps by day someone is working with the Americans or the coalition forces, and by night they're working with the Taliban, in part because they want to survive what's going on in that country.
Because the Taliban has the power to coerce them in ways that an occupying army does not, and is willing to stop at nothing in terms of exerting violence. So the challenge of counterinsurgency is creating a bubble of security within which people can make the choice to support the government. And that's long and hard and grinding, and really requires the building of capable host nation security forces, Iraqi forces, Afghan forces, who are loyal to their government and who will stand firm against assaults like that of the Taliban in Afghanistan or that of ISIS in Iraq. That's a long, hard, slow process. You can make it, you can speed it up and increase chances for success by embedding American advisors inside those units to model behavior and also to provide access to American combat multipliers like air power and intelligence. And that's the strategy that I advocate for the long haul, both in Iraq and in Afghanistan.
About a minute before our second break here, but is the goal democracy? Should that be the goal of U.S. foreign policy?
So democracies, stable democracies, tend not to go to war with each other, and certainly the trend is toward democracy. I think one of the big challenges of American foreign policy has been the trade-off between democracy and stability. We are making progress. Both Iraq has recently seen a successful democratic transition of power, as has Afghanistan. Two hugely important accomplishments that we don't celebrate nearly as much as we should. So there is still, even now, much to be optimistic about, both in Iraq and in Afghanistan.
And again, that's our guest, retired Lieutenant Colonel John Noggle. He is the headmaster of the Haverford School, which is located just outside of Philadelphia. And now we are talking about war. We're talking about the challenges posed by insurgencies, counterinsurgency policies. And again, he's the author of a new book called Knife Fights, a memoir of modern war in theory and practice. We have some callers that want to join our conversation after this very short break. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. What do you think about what you've heard so far? Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Pennsylvania Ballet supports WHYY and announces one of the most dynamic leaders in dance, Angel Correa, as the new artistic director. Accomplished, artistic, and highly energetic, Angel has danced with the world's prominent ballet companies. His Pennsylvania Ballet Artistic Director debut is Press Play, a mix of contemporary and traditional ballets. Pennsylvania Ballet's Press Play, October 16th through the 26th. For tickets, 215-893-1999 or paballet.org.
The Catholic Foundation of Greater Philadelphia supports WHYY. As a single source for charitable giving for people of all faiths, the Catholic Foundation administers a youth development fund. The fund welcomes donations to help disadvantaged and deserving youth grow up safer and happier. More information is available at 215-587-5650 or online at catholicfoundationphila.org. 215-587-5650 or catholicfoundationphila.org.
Did you grow up in a chaotic household or live with someone who abused drugs or alcohol? Over 60% of Americans grow up experiencing some type of household dysfunction, abuse, or neglect. The Penn Center for Women's Behavioral Wellness supports WHYY and is seeking menopausal women between the ages of 48 and 60 who experienced a stressful or chaotic childhood to participate in a study examining how early life stress affects memory later in life. Study participation includes brain imaging, blood draws, and memory tests. More information by contacting Claudia at 215-41-STUDY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. The call's coming in at 1-888-477-9499. John Nagle, let me read you a couple of emails here. This one is from Neil. He says, World War II was won by the Allies, not the United States. Why is the U.S. now virtually going it alone in fighting these insurgencies, which threaten the entire West?
That's a great question. The truth is that in the wake of the extraordinary threat to Western civilization posed first by the Axis powers during World War II, later by the Soviet Union and its allies, mostly coerced allies, during the Cold War, the international security threat has changed, and our allies have largely demobilized, given up an awful lot of their military capability. Also, quite frankly, they lost an awful lot of faith in the United States after the invasion of Iraq in 2003 and the bungled invasion that followed. So we've got a credibility gap with our allies. Right now, we are starting to see some help in the fight against ISIS. Again, as I've indicated, I think we're blowing a pretty uncertain trumpet. The president met with 21 leaders of allied militaries in the fight against ISIS last week in an attempt to convince them that we are taking this seriously. The repeated statements that we're not going to put boots on the ground don't help convince our allies that we're serious about this fight. So I'm hoping for a stronger clarion call from the president in the weeks ahead, the commitment of more American resources. I think that will unlock additional allied resources for this very important fight for, as Neil suggested, not just the United States, but all of us.
Neil, thanks for that question. How, though, do you propose Obama sell that to the American public? And I don't need to tell you that the public does not want us involved in future wars, so whether we are or not.
So the president has the extraordinary advantage of being a second-term president. He never has to face election again. It's a great time for him to exercise leadership. He also has the responsibility to exercise leadership, and part of that is getting people to do things that they don't necessarily want to do. I am now an old, broken former soldier, but a number of my friends are still serving. They're not super happy about going back to Iraq yet again. But if we're serious about it, if we are in fact going to hold what we clear this time, the key to the counterinsurgency strategy, clear, hold, and build, you've got to hold, and that's a long-term process. They would much rather do it again, hold it, so that their kids don't have to go fight in another Iraq war.
You're saying do it right?
Do it right, stick the landing, and stay there for the long term. As we've demonstrated, we know how to do around the globe, as we did in the wake of the Second World War, we did in the wake of the Korean War. We're still providing security in the former Yugoslavia. This is what the leader of the world does. And after the initial conflict, it doesn't cost that much in blood or in treasure.
And are you broken?
I'm a sad, shattered shell of a man.
Are you really? I'm serious.
I'm very fortunate not to have not to have been hit in either of my wars. There were some close calls, but I am now a much more effective, I think. Anyone who ever saw me carrying a weapon would agree that I'm much better able to help behind a keyboard.
But you also talk about, you know, the men you lost and being, in a sense, haunted by whether they were injured or whether they were killed.
And anyone who has served with this great generation of young Americans, all volunteers, and we rightly pay tribute to the greatest generation of World War II fame who came of age in the Depression and then defeated fascism on two continents. But two-thirds of those guys were draftees. So everyone who's fought in these wars for the last 15 years has been a volunteer, and these kids have been absolutely phenomenal. They've done everything we've asked of them and more. One of the reasons I wrote the book, one of the reasons I'm having this conversation, is we owe it to them when they put their trust in us, when they put their lives in our hands, in the hands of the foreign policy, national security mechanism of the United States. We owe it to them to ensure that we lose as few of them as possible, that we do so only when absolutely necessary in terms of accomplishing national security objectives of the United States, and that we think really, really hard before we engage in conflict. Mm-hmm. And so toward the end of that book of Knife Fights, I recommend a much more stringent attitude toward involving the United States in conflict abroad. I've said a number of times, the invasion of Iraq in 2003 was unnecessary. The invasion of Afghanistan in 2001 was a necessary war. That war and the current war against ISIS are, I believe, the only two times in the past 15 years that have been necessary uses of force on a large scale in the international system. And so interventions like the one in Libya, I would not have been in support of, I think was a mistake, in particular because we again violated St. Augustine's prescription. We didn't have a plan to build a better peace after we toppled the Libyan regime.
Let me read a tweet from Sapphire. Getting tough on ISIS is an idea complicated by reality on the ground. And I guess, I mean, also I think embedded in her comment is just, do you fight like ISIS in order to beat ISIS?
And we can't do that, and we won't do that. There are things that make the fight against ISIS difficult. In particular, the fight against ISIS inside Syria is enormously complicated because we don't have allies we can trust on the ground. The Iraqi army, the Kurdish forces inside Iraq, although they've suffered some setbacks, are capable, and we want them to take over. We want the government in Baghdad to take over Iraq and regain sovereignty over Iraq. We don't know at this point who we want to rule Syria. We don't want President Assad, the current ruler of Syria, who uses chemical weapons against his own people. He's a bad man. We want him to go. We also don't want ISIS to take over, and this is why the failure to arm moderate Syrian rebels in 2012 was such a mistake, because ISIS has killed most of those guys. Mm. There's really nobody left we want to take over in Syria.
Let me get Don from, looks like Chester Springs, to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Don. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, good morning. I'm a retired Air Force colonel, too old to have been personally involved in these wars, but I thought entering Iraq, as your speaker says, was a terrible mistake. And leaving as we did was a terrible mistake. The point I want to make, however, is I understand that we must have a status of forces agreement in every country where we leave anybody, or we are leaving ourselves very vulnerable. And Maliki would not give the Obama administration a satisfactory status of forces agreement, so we were unable to leave the 12 to 20,000 troops we wanted to leave. And I'll just take my answer off the air.
Sure, Don. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Go ahead, Don.
Don, thanks for your service. Maliki was willing to give us a status of forces agreement, but only one signed by executive order, signed by him as chief executive. He wasn't willing to run it through the parliament. We had operated under a similar arrangement from 2008 to 2011. There was, in my eyes, no reason not to continue to operate under it. And I will point out that we do currently have 1,500 troops in Iraq with less of a SOFA, one signed only by their foreign minister, their previous foreign minister, and not even by their prime minister. So we are currently operating in Iraq without a SOFA in combat, and we wouldn't have been in combat if we'd accepted the previous agreement with Maliki by executive order.
Don, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And John, you had said that you thought the U.S. should have armed the Syrian rebels fighting the Assad regime. Let me just quote something from the New York Times recently. The CIA has run guns to insurgencies across the world during its 67-year history, from Angola to Nicaragua to Cuba. The continuing CIA effort to train Syrian rebels is just the latest example of an American president becoming enticed by the prospect of using the spy agency to covertly arm and train rebel groups. An internal CIA study has found that rarely works. Can you speak to that?
Mm-hmm.
Because it does raise questions about, you know, training rebels and whose side are they on, and some of these mixed loyalties?
So this is a high-risk strategy, and I absolutely concur. Sometimes it's worth taking the risk. Often it's not. In this particular case, Assad was so bad and was creating such resentment, such anger, such hatred in his people that there was a pretty good rebellion going on. There were moderate Syrian rebels who we would have preferred to lead the country. And the choice to arm, train, and equip the Syrian rebels was something that was supported at the time by Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, Director of the Central Intelligence Agency, and my friend David Petraeus. And it's possible there's been a better national security team than those three, but it's hard to think of one. And so my advocacy for that choice is based in no small part on the fact that they looked at the risks, they looked at the upside, they thought that this was not a great option. But it was the least bad option available. And sometimes in foreign policy and national security policy, you have to take the least bad option available. We're now left with a much, much worse option.
Let me get to Andrew from, looks like, Bath, Pennsylvania to join us. Andrew, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
My question is twofold. The first is, how can we say it was a mistake to invade in 2003 when, by all objective standards, it was a murderous, genocidal dictator who we believe posed a threat to the United States. And then at the same time, we say we need to bleed in the streets of the Middle East to establish a democracy for them. Why don't we just put in a dictator like we did before if we're okay with having Saddam still in power? That doesn't seem like we're being coherent there.
Okay.
And second is, why do we need to always bleed for their democracy? Will it not make sense to use special operations to root out terrorist networks and at the same time use conventional forces to take out hard regimes and uniformed forces such as Iran and Syria and then walk away? Is it just too hard for Americans to stomach that sort of reality, or is it strategically not feasible?
Andrew, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And I'll go ahead.
Thanks, Andrew. So there's no doubt that Saddam Hussein was a bad guy in 2003. However, he had been contained. We were flying Operation Southern Watch, preventing him from using air power effectively. He was no longer a threat to his neighbors or his region. He was inflicting reasonably horrible punishment pain on some of his population. I'm not suggesting he was a nice guy, but there are a lot of bad people around the world who do bad things. My own test for employing American military power abroad is that we should do so only when there is a vital national interest of the United States at stake, frankly, when we are at risk. Saddam Hussein in 2003 posed us no risk. Even if he had had weapons of mass destruction, as I believed he did, I still didn't support the invasion. I thought that he could be deterred as a state actor. So that's why the 2003 invasion was a mistake. It is not our job to root out every bad guy in the world, only the ones who pose a clear and present danger to us. The reason I support taking on ISIS more effectively, more vigorously than we have to date, is that I do believe that ISIS does present that threat to us. In particular, I'm concerned that it is training up jihadis with Western passports who are going to be enormously difficult to track, to keep an eye on, and who I'm afraid are going to spread like Ebola for many years to come.
You question when I used the word defeat earlier. So if we're talking about ISIS, is it a matter of containing it, defanging them, minimalizing them, marginalizing them, perhaps hoping that people realize they do not want to live under a regime operated by ISIS?
This is a part of the fight against ISIS is part of a broader struggle against radical Islamists. We understand Al-Qaeda at this point pretty well. Al-Qaeda was the forerunner. They've really passed the torch onto ISIS. And we are looking at a generational struggle against radical jihadis, radical interpretations of Islam that are not supported by the Quran, but that espouse hate, hatred for women, hatred for the West, hatred for many of the regimes in the Middle East.
Do you defeat that, though?
Ultimately, they have to decide. They have to step away from it themselves. And so we contain it. We capture or kill the most committed adherents, we fight a more effective information operations campaign than we have, explaining how antithetical these ideas actually are to the basis of Islam. And we have not done, if we've had one failing at the national level, it has been that we have not conducted an effective information operations campaign against the jihadis who are spreading their hate over the internet, attracting Brits, attracting American citizens to join the jihad. That's an extraordinary failure on our part, and it's a real threat.
We have a comment from Aurelia on a slightly different note here. How does he, meaning you, compare the threat of an atomic Iran to Syria? We haven't, you know, thrown Iran into this conversation.
We have not. Iran is deeply involved in this fight, and the new Prime Minister of Iraq, Prime Minister al-Abadi, was recently in Iran for his first meetings with the government there. So I am actually a long-term optimist on Iran. Persia is the center, was a great center of civilization. The Persian people themselves are actually very pro-American. The government of Iran is obviously putrid. But like Saddam Hussein, I believe that American policy should be as it is to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. But I do believe that even if Iran were to acquire nuclear weapons, it could still be deterred. The problem with these non-state actors like ISIS is that they can't be deterred. They are willing to die. They are happy to die. And that is not the case for the Iranian regime. It fears annihilation. It wants to endure. The radical jihadis who are willing to die and have Western passports, I believe, are an enormous threat to the United States.
Do people from the U.S. government come and talk to you or invite you to come and talk to them?
I have the privilege to serve still on One Washington board. I'm in contact with my friends in Washington. The ideas I'm espousing here are not radically different from those of many of my uniformed friends, the uniformed leaders of the United States services, who believe that we should be taking a more active role against ISIS, that ISIS is a clear and present danger, that the president is right to want to defeat and ultimately to destroy it, but who are concerned, as I am, that we're not taking virulent enough action against this threat. We need to contain it early. We need to kill it early. We need to keep this infection from spreading. And at least to this point, the narrative of ISIS has been a very powerful one. It's been attracting adherents from around the globe. We need to stop that.
And that's John Nagel, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. Thanks for joining us today.
A pleasure, Marty.
And the book is called Knife Fights, A Memoir of Modern War in Theory and Practice. He's a retired lieutenant colonel, and he's also the headmaster of the Haverford School just outside of Philadelphia. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. We've posted some information on our Facebook page, and you can follow us on Twitter and, of course, download a podcast of the show. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Thanks for those calls, and do stay with us for hour two. We'll be right back.